Everybody, welcome to the Remember Erwin Hazen panel. In some places, it's I think it was listed as remembering the golden age with Erwin Hazen. That would be difficult. So I think I'm going to start and let Erwin speak for himself, and then I'll introduce the panel. If I can get this DVD to work, which of course doesn't seem I can. Pekka, what am I doing here? There's a movie, a wonderful movie about Erwin, that I get to this. So I can't find that. Well, I'll introduce the panel. Starting the end, Michael Uslan, who is the producer of all the Batman movies and has written The Boy Who Loved Batman, writes stuff for Archie and Dynamite and The Shadow, and it goes on and did the Stan Lee, books at DC. It's about 2% of your credit, right?
Yeah, it keeps me off the streets at night, it's fine.
And then Tim, all of you guys can do it.
Oh my God! I've got to talk about myself. It's so unused to that. I'm Ari Kaplan. I'm a writer for TV. I've written shows for PBS Kids and True TV and other fine basic cable networks. And I write a lot of scripts for DC Comics and also Archie and IDW and lately Dark Horse and Bongo as well.
I'm David Armstrong. I was in the entertainment business for 45 years and at one point was the president of the American Association of Comic Book Collectors and became good friends with Erwin, along with Carmen Infantino, and that's an interesting story, about 15 years ago, and kept up pretty much throughout the rest of his life. That's you.
I'm Shelley Mayer. I am the granddaughter of Sheldon Mayer, who's editor, Golden Age, and did Sugar and Spike, worked with Erwin in the 30s and 40s, and draw on pretty much everything, and Erwin was my best friend for the last 5 years.
And I'm Danny Fingeroth. I'm a writer and editor of Marvel for many years. I've wrote books, including Superman on the Couch. I wrote a book called The Sky is Clark Kent. News comics and creation of the superhero. And one of the people I interviewed that book was Erwin. And I guess kind of doing the research. So I've known Erwin, I knew Erwin for about 15 years. And I was one of the people who would go over and change his light bulbs or put the batteries in correctly, his flashlight, and also saw his work and was just inspired by him. Don't worry, don't doubt him. So I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I have, of course, probably the wonderful Dan McCarr movie about Erwin, but that is not happening. So I'm going to show you a couple of things, give you a quick overview of Erwin's career here. Here we go. That's Erwin drawing Gandhi, probably the character that he's best known for. Golden Age of Comics. That's a photo taken by Seth Kushner, who recently passed away, and was a wonderful photographer and writer. And as Erwin had his drawing board, that was taken for the promotion for Erwin's movie, Erwin the New York Story. That's a Dewey Clinton High School in the Bronx, where Stan Lee, Bob Kane, Bill Finger, and the others at Erwin Hazen attended high school. There's something about the water up there in the Bronx, I guess. Erwin started out, among other things, as a sports cartoonist. Here's a sports page he did about Joe Louis and some other boxers. And here, Erwin worked for a magazine called Bang Magazine, which now might have a different meaning, but then it was a ring magazine, and this is some of his sports photos. Here's a sports illustration, box illustration. This was Mr. Gray, as I recall, his name was Frankie Carlo. He was pals with the guys at Bang Magazine, and he was instrumental in Erwin losing his virginity. But that's the story.
He was losing his pimple.
So that you might watch the whole movie for that. This is Erwin from Erwin's lover boy, I think, but it's Erwin's autobiography, and him giving copy of some boxing hits from Mike Tyson. The boxing thing continued. This is Irwin with a woman named Gertrude Berg. She was the creator of a show called The Goldbergs. Not The Goldbergs is on now. The original Goldbergs from the great radio and television. It was the first sitcom about a Jewish American family, and Irwin did the newspaper strip The Goldbergs. It was through Gertrude Berg that he had his book. Irwin had his close encounter with Frank Sinatra one day when he was meeting with her in the town, and she said, Irwin said, this skinny kid with pimples came over. I guess Luther King is always a kid with pimples, you know. And this was the Goldberg strip. It ran for about a year in the New York Post, and nobody's ever collected it, have they? This would be something worth finding and collecting. And then Irwin, in the golden age, did The Fox for MLJ, which has been brought back by Dean Haskell and Mark Waid, who was a recent comment. Catman. Who was Catman for, Irwin?
Holyoke, was it?
Holyoke. Yeah. Sorry. Irwin did Catman. He's in Marvel Mystery Comics number 4, I believe, was the debut of The Ferret by Irwin and the writer. We know the writer was So Irwin actually did work for Marvel before almost anybody else. Wildcat is one of his most famous creations. Of course, he wrote back and he got in cartoons. He created that with Batman co-creator, Bill Finger. And Irwin was an early artist at Green Lantern. And of course, Wonder Woman. Irwin was about 5'2", but he did like very tall women. So Wonder Woman was a natural for him. He drew All-Star Comics. Which had the team-ups of the superheroes, and then of course Gandhi came along when Irwin found himself. He would say that when you were a cartoonist out of work, you'd say you were advertising. So one day he met Gus Edson, and then he said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "I'm doing advertising." And together they came up with Gandhi, which ran for 30 years in newspapers, and New Yorker was the Daily and Sunday News. And Irwin loved those Gandhi eyes, which he used to make himself to charm anybody into doing anything. He was Irwin in Central Park, doing a public demonstration of drawing. And there's a bunch of artists. I know the one behind him is Leonard Starr, which is the tall one behind him. But I think Irwin just liked hanging around with guys who were shorter than him. There weren't that many, but luckily many of them were stellar cartoonists. This is, if you make it out, Irwin with Summer in the Hamptons, with celebrities like Joseph Heller and Betty Friedan. And so they're all introducing themselves. I'm not going to say I'm Joseph Heller, I'm Betty Friedan, I'm Sean Alexander. And Irwin would say, I'm drunk. With the bartender says, can I have your autograph? This is a National Cartoonist Society, I think a USO event, and you may recognize standing on Irwin's right is Will Eisner, who of course is prominent in every facet of comics in this convention. Who's that on the right of the hat? Is that Kniff? Or
Kniff.
Kniff. So the Irwin was counted among the greats. Irwin also was pal with Carl Sandburg in a guitar society in New York. So there's Irwin lower left, and Carl Sandburg serenading him. Pretty good. Irwin with his pal Rube Goldberg, with the up-to-date beachwear. So that's a very cool description. Irwin with Cindy Koufax. This is from Irwin's personal collection, so.
So the first time I met Irwin was when we did a tribute to Jerry Robinson, and we had already had dinner and we're waiting for the award ceremony, and so we were sitting with Carmine, and Carmine starts drawing because they never stop drawing, you know. So the cover is basically that paper cover on top of Marketplace, comic book Marketplace. So Irwin sees Carmine drawing, so he picks up his pen and he starts drawing. And so I afterwards. After he finishes, I look at it, and I grab it from him, and I take a look at it. So he's sitting, he had drawn a piece of, he'd shown Carmine and myself, and then wrote a whole long story. He loved writing long little passages. So the next slide shows what he finished up with. And then he took a different colored pencil to do a little caricature of himself to put on there. So he was trying to top Carmine, but he also wanted to send something to me, which I thought was very cute. But he never stopped drawing. Everyone will tell you that he would be sitting there at a convention on his own with no one else around, with his head down, sitting there drawing. Well, everyone else is trying to figure out what to do. He was a ball of fire, that's for sure.
So, thank you, Dave. And just to wrap up with a few, this is Irwin's birthday on Friday.
73 when Alex Toth happened to also be in. And you've never seen such camaraderie. Camaraderie, laughing, talking about the old days, going out. I can imagine. I think their lunches were 4 hours long. And that was my first exposure to Irwin. And even though I was just, you know, a teenager with long hair, he took the time to tell me about himself and let me pester him with questions, and was one of the most jovial, and you know, I finally figured it out, the correct term is rascal. He is one of the most jovial rascals I ever met in my life. Then I had a chance many, many years later to get serious with Irwin when I interviewed him for a documentary on the history of comics. And we went up to his place and we spent an awful lot of time with him. And he allowed me to get personal with him in my questions. He did not refuse to answer anything. He was frank. He gave me his philosophy on comics, his philosophy on the business industry, and his philosophy on life. There's two ways I most remember Irwin. One is what he did for this industry, for DC Comics, for any fan of comic books or superheroes. And as you can see from the slides, he had some kind of fetish for animals, because it seemed like everything he created had the name of an animal attached to it.
They weren't bigger than him.
Or that.
Yeah, amen.
He recalled for me when he sat down with Shelley Mayer, and all these superheroes were happening, and it was like, Shelley said, come on, go out there and create your own superhero. Give me a superhero. We're coming up with Sensation Comics. I need superheroes. He goes, I don't know what to do. He goes, Erwin, you were in a fight racket? Erwin said, yeah. He goes, you know lots about the fight business? He goes, yeah. You know about the ring? Yeah. He goes, go do a superhero about the fighting racket and that whole thing. And that's what set Erwin out to create Wildcat. And then go to his friend Bill Finger, who, of course, he would wind up doing some really, really great things with. And Wildcat was born. So he gave us Wildcat. He gave us some of the greatest Golden Age Green Lanterns. I remember him most as a kid for giving me the first ever truly beautiful Wonder Woman. I admired H.G. Peters' Wonder Woman, and I fell in love with Erwin Hayson's Wonder Woman. So in terms of the business, and it's All-Star Comics, my God, he helped present to us all the Justice Society of America, which changed the course of comic books for and superheroes for all of us. But as a person, what I got most from Erwin is to love what you do in life. Find your passion, make it your work, embrace every day. Get up every day with a smile. Don't let it get you down. Bounce back. Keep pressing forward. Get out of your comfort zone. I never met anyone except my own dad who so loved and embraced life. And that is the greatest thing that I will always take from my relationship with Erwin.
Yeah, that sounds right. Are you going to give us a background on Erwin and his generation of creators? Anything you
want to
say about that?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I didn't know Erwin as much as Michael did. I didn't get to know him, but I did know him, and probably one of the reasons I'm on this panel in the first place is because I wrote a book called From Crack Up to Krypton, Jews and Comic Books, which came out in 2008. I didn't get to interview Erwin for the book, but I did talk about him a little bit, and I did a ton of research into, like Danny said, that whole generation of writers and cartoonists and publishers, and got to know a lot of them while writing the book, folks like Jerry Robinson, Stan Lee, Joe Kubert. And what I find so fascinating about that whole generation is just the stick-to-itiveness and the kind of the work ethic that they all had is incredibly inspirational to my generation of comic book writers. And also, you know, just the fact that a lot of these folks were just trying to make a living during the Great Depression. And a lot of them, you know, some of these people, I mean, Stan Lee's family never had any money, so he was supporting his whole family at a certain point, but people like Erwin, their family was kind of well-to-do before the Depression, and then the bottom fell out, they didn't have anything, and Erwin had to get to work and try to support them as well. The other thing that I find kind of fascinating is that, you know, Ted Grant, the Wildcat character, is a boxer, that whole generation also, a lot of them seem to be very obsessed with boxing. We don't know this today, but back then, in the 30s and 40s, boxing was the number two sport in America, right behind baseball. And that really informed the work of a lot of writers and cartoonists in that era. I wrote a story about prize fighter for Dark Horse recently, and I became immersed in boxing lore, especially from the 1930s, and it really gave me a lot of respect for Erwin's work. I reread a lot of his Wildcat stories while writing my Dark Horse story, and it really, that's one of the things about Wildcat that I found so great is that the first thing is that the mask is so uniquely designed that even as a kid, the Wildcat mask, I found there was something really interesting aesthetically about it. It wasn't the obvious choice for a mask or a headdress for a superhero, but the other thing is that, yeah, okay, so his alter ego, Ted Grant, is a prize fighter. That means he already knows how to fight. He already actually has some fighting chops. He can actually go and, you know, fight crime. He can actually do that. Whereas, I don't know, if you're a wealthy playboy, you might not have those skills innately, so you have to sort of explain a lot. But, you know, just in general, just I hope I'm that active and that energized at 96. I mean, like everyone on this panel said so far, he was really drawing up until the very end, and it's pretty incredible.
And then Michelle, when you came in there, was like 2 years ago. Want to talk about that and how your relationship with him developed and what it meant to him?
Well, I would...
And to you.
Go ahead.
And to you.
Danny introduced us, actually. I was working on Still Am, a book on my grandfather, and I wanted to know more about the early stories. So I went over to see Irwin, and at first he really wasn't all that interested. He said, "What for?" Of course, it's a female, so he got over it fairly quickly. And immediately he grabbed my sketchbook and started drawing a picture of me with my markers, which was just amazing. And he kept remarking how much I look like my grandfather, and went through my portfolio and kept asking.
You have a picture of your grandfather, aren't you?
I do. So he would always go through my book and give me tips and tell me, "You can't tell anyone how good you are. Just hand it to them and let them go through and go, yeah, we need to use this." And the vitality that he showed and the passion for the work before it was popular to be a comic book artist. These guys did this because it was like breathing for them. And drawing was as important to their survival as well as their income. And it wasn't a popular thing to say it was a comic artist. It was actually a bit embarrassing for a while because it was accused of destroying America's youth and not being real literature and being corrosive to the minds of children. So they took a lot of flack for it, and they still stood, and they made a real pathway for all of us to do the things that we do now. Because it was a passion, and because they felt so strongly about this mode of communication and through the filter of how they're experiencing the world. And without that, a lot of us wouldn't at all have an opening to do what we do with the freedom that we have.
Well, I have a tribute from Jules Feiffer that Donald Irwin's still alive. Not outdoors, but with a fly book. But Jules, everyone knows that Feiffer worked with, for, and idolized Will Eisner. But it's lesser known how much Jules loved and admired, and did work with Irwin Hayes as well. So I wanted to. So Jules had made his tribute on an event at the Society of Illustrators in New York last year. When Irwin was in between life threatening conditions and illnesses, which is why we were all shocked, even though he was 96 when he died. He was a guy who bounced back so many times with this will to live that was astonishing. Because you go visit him in the hospital, and right, you know, well, I better say goodbye, because I've never seen this guy again. He cut to, you know, 2 months later.
There's Irwin.
So this is Jules' tribute to Irwin. If I can make the technology work, let's see if I have better luck with this than the DVD. Ooh, what?
Wow. Speaker making any noise?
Well, I have the exterior speaker plugged in, so I'll take that out of the car. I'll try it again. Thank you for your question. This time for sure.
That was nice.
I'm here with Jules Pfeiffer, and we're talking about our old pal, Irwin Hayes.
Do you believe it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fairly optimistic.
Danny, you know, when I was listening to the thing about line work,
yeah.
and I heard Michael talk about the people coming into this to D.C. I knew Alex Toth for about 40 years and spent a lot of time with him in the last 3 months of his life. And I said, you know, we ended up talking about Irwin. I didn't know this, but Alex considered Irwin his mentor. And for two reasons. One, he loved hanging out with him. And he used to bring Irwin back to his mother's house so that his mother would cook meals for them and they'd hang out all night. And then Irwin would teach him about nightlife, and he kind of thought that was really cool at 18 or 19 years old. But the simplicity of his line work is what he really, really followed. And you know, the funny thing is, I never got that until he sat down and actually explained it. And it's interesting that Pfeiffer talks about it in that piece. But it's the cleanness of the line, you know, that Alex adored. And he kind of took it to a different level when he started working. But it's amazing to think about. And there was about a 20-year difference in their ages. So he really thought of him as a kind of father/teacher.
But the funny thing is that Irwin really looked up to Toth.
Yeah, exactly. Because the funny thing is, I would say that to Irwin, and Irwin would go, he'd look at me with this puzzled look like, what the hell are you talking about? The guy's a genius. I said, yeah, but where did he start? And he looks at me like, I don't know.
I thought, for me personally, you know, getting to know Irwin, he was old in body, but not in spirit, and he would be up for anything. You know, he'd go to conventions with the help of Dan McCara, who also produced and directed that movie that I couldn't tell you where it's from. But you should seek it out, which will be hard for me to talk about that after. Irwin was just up for anything. I think he sometimes regretted not having a family, you know, or children. So he was pretty much alone. So his friends were the other cartoonists. And since when you get to be close to 96, many of your friends are no longer available. You know, he made many friends with youngsters like us, people under 60 and under, or in the neighborhood, really kids. You know, we had a part of the Reader's Party at his house. He was really with it, and you know, just had this incredible spirit that people who had been through the adversity that he had been through, especially those health issues last year, might not have. He was just pretty inspiring. It's hilariously funny, and many descendants of his fellow common crows have come to visit them. They would get more than they bargained for, because Irwin would not be afraid to talk about the dark side of people, as well as their bright and positive sides. But he was just a lot of fun, and he really is still shining today. So, David, you had something you wanted to say about Irwin?
Well, I first met Irwin back in.
Can you identify yourself?
My name is David Siegel. And starting back in the late 1980s, I started working on a plan to bring out the Golden Age and Silver Age artists to San Diego Con. Up for the 1990s, you saw the Golden Age panels. I was the backbone of all that stuff. And I went out and tracked artists from the past, everybody who I could get my hands on. In 1993, I met Irwin Hasen for the very first time. Is like I would make, being born in Los Angeles, I would used to spend my vacation times going to the East Coast and doing this driving across the East Coast, making contacts with every artist I can get my hands on, and writers as well. And it took me time, but back in 1988, I got Irwin Hasen nominated as a guest to San Diego Con. He was out here in 1999. And last year at the Hall of Fame Eisner Award, this is very hard to see him get his award is great. And last year I was in New York City, went to go visit him at his apartment, and seeing having that Eisner Award there was great. And he was a great guy.
Michael,
do you
remember anything
about
when he
gave it to him? Yeah. It was just great. He was just a great guy.
He welcomed us into his halls.
Yeah. Jenny, I have to tell you, when to have the privilege with Danny and Paul Levitz and the group of us that were there to present him with his award for his real lifetime of achievement was very moving. But at the same time, I was sad. I was sad because when we presented his award, the turnout was about the same number of people as are here today. And I said something to Erwin about, you know, we're competing with Marvel's Ant-Man presentation down the hall where there are 5,000 young fans jammed in. And Erwin said, you know, the price you pay for growing old is that you lose your associates, your friends, your family, your fans. And he said, it's not about the number of seats in the room. It's the fact that Comic-Con, representing my fellow professionals and representing my 75 years of generations of fans, is giving me this. And then, in one of the rarest moments, to find Erwin choked up and tearing up, he says, this symbolizes all of that for me. It's not about the number of people in the seats. And he truly teared up, as I did. And that, to me, was a particularly poignant moment. I was really, really happy to have been a part of that, with us representing all you guys.
To a banquet,
I've been
to
Adam and Jim Salicro. Someone who was there when Michael, for the story Michael Salicro.
Yeah.
Erwin, really, it's, he didn't even seem to notice, but he would look at the ones who were there and light up at every
one
of them. And he felt the world of these individuals. He lit up at the mention of your name. The first time I was ever talking to him, he lit up when they entered the room. He would be very honored and thrilled that you all are doing this today.
And by the way, if he was here with a mic, none of us would be able to talk. He would take over the entire hour, and he'd have people in stitches. He was the greatest Toastmaster I ever met, I think.
Yeah, no, sounding like Maurice Chevalier.
No, when I was in 2010, I believe, I moderated a panel on World War II and comics with Erwin and Al Jaffe, who I've also known for a long time. I was supposedly the moderator of the panel, but like in name only, because, I mean, it was really the Erwin Hasen show for the next hour, which I was happy to give. What am I going to stop him from talking? He's the living legend. I'm not. Not yet. And so he is, you know, he just was a great storyteller, just in person, on paper, in every way possible.
Any offensive imitations of any race, creed, yes. Culture, including his own?
Yes, yes. Chevalier.
Chevalier, if you've ever heard his imitation of a rabbi, then you missed something. I'm not going to attempt to do it with Erwin. Any ethnic regional accent, Shelley, would you want to say something?
Well, Carmine Infantino's first trip to D.C., he went to the door of my grandfather's office, and Erwin had come in past him and hopped up on the desk with my grandfather, and they got into this incredible duel with T-squares and things flying everywhere while Carmine is standing there with his portfolio like, what am I walking into?
It was Carmine and Frankie Coyle.
Yes.
And they both ran the hell out of
the road. And they did it for a bunch of while, and Erwin hops off the desk and goes off with his...
Jim, do you have any...
No, I think probably everyone said all the interesting things already. Sorry I'm late, but the first time I saw was probably 1968 or so. The NCS was having a celebration of the 75th anniversary of comic strips, and to celebrate, they were having something in Central Park in the band shell, and D. Do you have photos from that?
Is that it?
I don't know if that's the one, but what it was is all the artists, you know, from all the Sunday News, Daily News, comic strips were there, and they were wearing their cartoonist blazers, and they had their easels, and they were going to draw pictures of their characters. But the I don't know why, I was only, I don't know, 11 years old at the time, but I thought it was hilarious that seeing finally, after growing up, every Sunday seeing Dundee in the back cover of the Sunday News, that, you know, all these cartoonists were pretty much average height or fairly tall, and then at the end of the line was the Dundee cartoonist, and he was like about the size of Dundee. I thought that was totally appropriate. And over the years, my father had taken me to that, because I lived in the Bronx, I was in Manhattan, so that was a big deal. But over the years, I think five generations of my family in different forms have gotten to see, you know, Irwin in different ways. And the last being probably in Ramapo, the conventions we went, Danny and I and Irwin and Arnold Drake.
Oh, yeah, we got to talk about that.
Yeah, and, but there was one where he was on a panel with, I think, Joe Sinnott and Joe Staten, and I had my second cousins who were both teachers of their children, and they're, you know, from a fairly religious, you know, conservative, well, they're not conservative, but, you know, and, you know, Joe and Joe were both telling stories that were suitable for family consumption, but of course, you know, Irwin is Irwin. The stories are what they are. When he would start telling, you know, like the two, Sinnott and Staten were both sort of elbowing him and saying, there's kids here. You know, this was like, and, but that was Irwin, and my cousins were fine about it, said, don't worry about it. You know, like they probably hear worse in that very school. So he was someone, if you knew him, you loved him. His work was. Yeah, you almost, to say he's underrated is almost an exaggeration. He was so good, you sort of took it for granted, and his personality was so big that it sort of overshadowed how great an artist he was. So, you know, so I'm sure everyone's heard all this before, so, but that was, you know,
I remember about those cartoons. Alan Rosenberg had a school teacher in Rapid, now it's in New Jersey, you have regular local New York shows. And so Jim and I would, Ken Wong, who used to be the head of MoCA, would drive me and Jim and Irwin and Arnold Drake. And they're talking about writing a history, you know, it was pretty wild. And Arnold was hilarious and had all sorts of Batman and Batman stories. Again, maybe not suitable for print, but Jim and I would be sitting with Irwin between us in the back, and Irwin would be dozing really peacefully. And I said to Jim, did Irwin just die? and then Irwin would, you know, just say something so hilariously funny. I guess he didn't. He's still, you know, but those rides, you know, really bribing sometimes. It's hard. I'm New Yorkers, like news to me. When you're riding cars with people, it sometimes makes for interesting revelatory experiences. Anyway, does anybody have any questions for these folks, or thinking about Irwin, or memories of Irwin your own?
What do you think the most important thing people should remember about Irwin?
Wow.
One of the most important things, you tell us, like, well, this is why this guy matters. I actually heard some of the conversation I was having not too long ago. It's like, he didn't create these characters, he was drawn to my brother. It's like, he created a wildcat, and so did great Green Lantern. It's like, my thought is like,
he didn't let any of the Meshuggah get in his way either. When his height limited the ethnicity at the time was a problem. The things with Gus Edson, when he took full credit, he didn't let any of that get in his way. He didn't hold on to the bitterness. Like, if that idiot hadn't done this, he'd make a face and he'd get up and he'd figure out how to make it work. And he'd do it with a smile.
And I think his personality is shown through in his work. And I think that's kind of what you get out of it. For me, anyways. Armin Schumer's got it.
Sure. The way I would answer Travis's query is that is that Irwin Hasen reached a dream that so many artists and cartoonists never reach. Not only did he create characters, obviously, that are still being used, but the 20th century cartoonist's dream was to get a newspaper syndicated comic strip daily and Sunday for how many years?
30
years! That should still be honored in the 21st century as an incredible achievement. And God bless Irwin that he made it.
And it wasn't always compensated to the level that he deserved. It was really, at times it was, but it was a labor of passion and love. He really believed and wanted to do what he was doing, and it came through in his line and his characters and the way he felt about it.
But aside from all his achievements, and aside from his great philosophy that he passed down to us, I would like to respect Irwin and his memory as representing the thousands of people of prose in this business over the last 75, 80 years who showed up for work every day, worked hard, got their scripts done, got their pencils done, got the lettering done, the inking done, the editing done. The people in the trenches every single day, still to this day, who are working at home in solitude, or working in an office, or working in a cubicle, to give us the entertainment, the mythology, the characters whom we have all fallen in love with generation after generation, who were fighting as hard as they could to keep a roof over their families' heads and food on the table. And in the process of doing this long, hard, very creative work, loving it. And day in and day out. And so many of them today, except for probably those of us who are here today, these people are virtually nameless now. We know who they were. We know who they are. And I think Irwin represents the best of what that all stood for.
I need to say this.
He had an apartment in the greatest part of Manhattan you can have an apartment in for years. That might be more of an achievement than a cartoonist.
Rent control.
Yeah, rent control.
On the Upper East.
Yeah, I guess he, if the lesson of our lesson is keep the sense of wonder about me and the fighting spirit of Wildcat, that's a good quote for anybody here right now. But I think that really is. That's the early main thing, or the sense of wonder of God being the fighting spirit of Wildcat. Yes.
And he loved people.
One of the things that I feel so strongly about Irwin is that he had the generosity of spirit to pass on to all of us.
And it was genuine.
I'm sorry?
It was totally genuine.
Yeah, a completely generous person. And that's why we all loved being with him.
I got a quick story.
Okay.
Probably everyone on the panel knows this story, but you know, when he first went out looking for jobs in Manhattan, one of the places he went to was the Daily Worker. And you know, and he knew nothing about politics. He just thought it was another newspaper. So he went and he took his sports cartoons, and the guy said, "These are great. We can use these." And he said, "How much do I get paid?" And the guy looked at him and said, "Paid? You don't pay anyone." He goes, "Well, I'm going to get paid." He goes, "Well, you have to go upstairs and talk to the editor, so-and-so." So he goes upstairs and talks to the editor. He goes, "No, this is for the cause." He goes, "Fuck that. I'm taking my cartoons back." That's Irwin.
That's Irwin. So where can everybody find you guys at the convention?
I'm at the Paper Cuts booth at 2546. I'm there most of the time with someone on another panel. Hopefully I'll show up on that.
And I think, aren't we judging cosplay tonight?
Oh, sorry. Michael and I are judging the costumes. narrative section of the Castle Conference.
Yeah, it's really an awful lot of fun.
So, I was there, and I read where can you bring you now? Do you have a website or something?
I do. It's my name, but the thing is that my parents decided to be clever. There's a silent E at the end of my name, with not like, you know, Ari on Entourage, that amazing movie that came out a few weeks ago. But it's ARIEKPLAN.com. And that's where you can find more information about some of my upcoming book projects and video game and TV projects as well, and a lot of the comics that I'm working on.
Can't find me. We have to stop.
I'm at Peaceful Shades online, peacefulshades.com, and my Instagram and Facebook is all of that if you want to see my art.
I'm at
I want a picture.
Thank you, everybody.